It's the 19th of May 2003. This is an interview with Michigan State University Distinguished Professor Emeritus John Hunter, who has been on the faculty at Michigan State since 1967. The first questions will be from MSU Distinguished Professor of History David Robinson.
Thank you, Peter. It's exciting to be here with John Hunter because of all of his experience in West Africa and at Michigan State. I thought we might begin with what Gold Coast and Ghana represented in the early years of your work, John, at a very exciting time in the 1950s.
True, it was a very exciting time. Elements of serendipity in it. I was conscripted into the British Army and appointed eventually to a commission in the Royal West Africa Frontier Force. And they flew me out in a memorable flight in an unpressurized bomber, I think at Wellington. We flew from Gatwick, then a military airport, now a civilian. Spent the night in Libya, overnight waiting for the desert to cool. And we crossed over to Kano. And that was my first introduction to African climates because the pencils I was carrying split with the low humidity. It was down to like 2 or 5% humidity. And that was an introductory experience. But I was appointed in the Royal West Africa Frontier Force and served for 2 years. And our mission was to prepare soldiers, African soldiers, for coming independence throughout British colonial West Africa. So from the outset, my experience in Ghana had much broader dimensions to it than simply arriving in the Gold Coast and serving in it, because we trained soldiers from Gambia, from Sierra Leone, from the Gold Coast, of course, from Cameroon, and preponderantly from Nigeria. So from the very beginning, my first foot in Africa, it was to meet with different Africans from different West African countries. So that set a tone for me that probably had an influence on my thinking about Africa.
What year was that you went?
1955. Yeah. And then so for the first 2 years, we were camped out on the coastal plains of Ghana, and I became aware of the ecological differences between the Gulf of Guinea fishing villages on the coast from the Accra Plains and the lifestyles associated with that, because we did military training and I set up a night compass march exercise. I had great fun. And my trainees loved it too. I was a captain. And we also marched into the forest over the Akwapim Ridge. Then it was close canopy high forest. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, it's stripped entirely bare of all trees. It's traumatic to see the differences. But in those first 2 years in Ghana, although I worked in the military context, it was broad, and I took advantage of all geographical opportunities arising. Mm-hmm. From that base camp with a colleague, we drove down to Nigeria and mm-hmm. traveled by deck cargo on a steamer down to Cameroon and climbed Mount Cameroon mm-hmm. in the rainy season, which was forbidden by law because of loss of life, 400 inches. Mm-hmm. But we had, as always, truly sturdy, loyal, responsible African guides, without whom we would have been lost totally. So my first introduction to Ghana was actually a military one, mm-hmm. but modified to give me broader dimensions mm-hmm. and a very keen appraisal of the geographical environment.
Was Accra or somewhere near Accra the headquarters for the West African Frontier Force?
We're in a village called Teshi, and then Labadi was there too. So it was, now it's in suburban Greater Accra. In those days it was out on the open plains. Yeah.
And did you see some of the swollen shoot problems with the cocoa? Was that going on at the time?
No. Yes, it would be going on. Mm-hmm. But in fact, I would then have to leap forward 2 years because I took an appointment. I was offered two jobs through the University of London, who had a post-colonial development program for the University of Ghana in Lagos, and a very fine, elegantly constructed university was there, of course. And I had two job offers there, one in, although I was serving in the army at the time, one in geography and one in education. And being a geographer, being essentially at heart a guy who draws maps, I kept to my expertise.
So you stayed on then after the 2 years of military service?
Yes.
Translated into work at Ligon.
Right. In fact, that I had the choice of I had done my PhD fieldwork in industrial history or the geography of mostly 19th century industrial growth, some in 18th, archival and field interview research in Nottingham. And I'd been invited to apply for a post there in Nottingham. But the excitements of Africa just took over my life. Mm-hmm. Loved it. Mm-hmm. And consciously made the decision to accept the University of London post.
So you stayed on, you were there at Independence and stayed on?
Yes, but I actually had to come back to be demobilized for about 6 months and worked up in the Preston Barracks as an acting unpaid major, and again doing development programs, education, all this education. But then left immediately to return to Ghana, but now to Lagon, the new university.
Did you feel yourself caught up in the excitement that I know a lot of Thomas Hodgson and
yes.
even W.E.B. Du Bois from
yes.
a very different context must
right.
have felt in those years?
My field didn't automatically lead me into those arenas, but you couldn't help but be infected by the euphoria of coming independence, then independence itself. And Ghana in those days was like a magnet attracting Du Bois, I don't know how you would pronounce it, but I saw him in Ghana. And he was wheeled in a wheelchair onto the stage, a very feeble old gentleman. But widely praised and symbolic. And the USIS, US government in Accra, helped tremendously, of course, in that they brought out Louis Armstrong and his group, and they played at Achimota College, and barely a week went by without some famous, there was a huge concert for independence down on the beach in Accra. Well, it was a raised beach level, geomorphologically raised beach, huge level area of hard, compacted sand, so it's a perfect arena. And I remember some famous American artists, black American artists, came and entertained us. We were all there. Mm-hmm. It was a thrilling, euphoric period. And we were everyone was full of hope and optimism. And that's infectious.
Yes. And the university.
Excuse me, the name I was searching for because there are big holes in my memory. Tina Turner was there. And she must have been, in those days, like a young girl, teenager.
And the excitement was there at the university too.
Absolutely, extremely so. And the university, I was hired through London, but there were all different kinds of profs turned up there, some of whom became quite famous later on.
Now, did Ivor Wilkes arrive at about that time?
Yes, he was there, and he worked in history, but also in African studies, and he was able to synthesize the two fields and had a wonderful reputation as an important scholar. And also intimidating beer drinker. So
yes, I think Ivor's capacities followed him to Evanston.
Oh, really?
Despite the temperance union.
Yeah.
As I recall going to Evanston about 30 years ago, there was a street that marked the boundary of Evanston and whatever is west. And if you wanted to go to a bar, you had to cross the street. That's where Ivor held his seminars.
Yes, he did. But he was a serious scholar and well-respected. And there were many others like him on the campus in different fields, in archaeology. And I can't instantly recall all the names, but including some well-known black African scholars too, who later became held important positions.
And what kind of work were you doing in those
In the earliest days, I worked in the forest, and my major interests were the migration into the forest and it was a commercial migration of cocoa farmers who transformed the landscape, and it has to be one of the largest agricultural migrations orchestrated, and it was extremely orderly because without taking measurements of square feet, square meters, and so on, it was all carefully calibrated without units of measurement of area. It was all done by linear measurement through traditional methods of so-called ropes or hand span 6 feet, nautical span 6 feet. But they used linear measurements to obtain proportionate aerial outcomes by farming through the high forest and changing it from hunting grounds of the Achim peoples into cocoa farms by migrants from different, totally different language groups and ethnic groups, because the cocoa had been introduced by missionaries onto the hills of Aquapim, and the land was seemed to be empty. Of course, it wasn't. It was used as hunting grounds and so on. But the thing is that the ownership of the land was peacefully transferred from the owning ethnic language groups to ownership and economic development by 20 or 30 different language groups. I shouldn't say that. 20 or ethnic and language mixed.
And they were from Gold Coast and from Upper Volta?
The Upper Volta came as labourers. They didn't have the wherewithal to buy land. You had to buy land. So that's really what was fascinating. Polly Hill did a lot of work on this. And I did a lot of mapping, and she used some of my maps on the cover of her book on migration of cocoa farmers. But the point I'd like to stress here is that it's indicative of Ghanaian temperament that it was peaceful. There wasn't a militaristic land invasion. There wasn't any fighting over the land. It was all done commercially. whereby the invading migrants were commercial invaders buying land from mostly matrilineal landholders who had usufructuary systems of dividing a land, whereas the patrilineal migrants coming into Meg, they had a different system, and I was mapping out the two systems. So to me it was fascinating.
And did the Achim chiefs play a role in this?
Of course, they had to sell the land.
It was Stu land, or it was...
Yes,
it belonged to the chiefs.
Individuals didn't own the land. In the matrilineal system, the village, the village as a whole owned the land under the Achim chiefs.
And were you teaching and training students, Ghanaian students, at the same time in these, in mapping and the other things?
Yes, I was. Yes, I was. So the research I did on my own initiative, it was not funded. All you have to do is sit down in the forest and look around and see what's happening, and it captures your interest. I had other interests. My first research was on geomorphology. Because I was trained as an undergraduate in that area by Austin Miller, the famous climatologist and geomorphologist. So I wanted to follow in his footsteps. I couldn't do it. I didn't have the skills. But my first publications were on river capture and erosional history, post-Gondwana, you know, the break up of the continents, post-Gondwana river adaptations. And I did that, and I even found some outlying fragmented Voltaic sandstone boulders to confirm the post-Gondwana retreat and so on. But once I really got into the heart of the forest, and the cocoa then, of course, later, because of the intensive cultivation of cocoa, the more pure the stands of any plant life, the more vulnerable the plant life is to disease attack. And so the cocoa plantations, which brought wealth and education, high levels of education and prosperity to Ghana, I know when Prince Philip came to Ghana to open the university formally, he said, well, we have to, he said something jocular, flippant like, thank God for cocoa, because it's paid for all this magnificence. We were sitting in a huge outdoor arena, but that's true. It was financially solvent, and the university was built on cocoa money, and there was a big balance too for the government to use.
Were you there when the dam was constructed on the Volta?
Yes, and of course years before. I did a canoe trip down from the Impreso and Cocoa Highlands. Thoroughly boring trip, but down to the site of the new dam, just for the spirit of adventure of it. But boring because, I mean, there were 15-foot reeds on the... We spent 3 days in the reeds going down the Afram River. And I would like to get out and meet with people and do measurements and survey and questions. Yeah. And you're trapped in a canoe, screened off by reeds, being bitten to death by mosquitoes. Right. But it was an adventure.
Yeah. Did some of your medical interests begin to develop from that time? Or
no,
was that
except with the swollen shoe disease, of course, that's medical in the sense it applies to plant life. But no, it was when I'd exhausted several years of effort in the forest working, and also I took a couple of years off to work for Ghana government as the census officer in charge of the mapping. That was a United Nations UNESCO project. And we were on the university payroll, so we were not paid for the work, but it was a great challenge. It was the first census, full census in Africa, that was characterized by complete 100% coverage. We did it by mapping. We did produce a map, and that was my job. For each census officer, each enumerator had his own cardboard satchel, which he made with his a map of his own area, with a detailed boundary description. Mm. So we produced a lot of integrity to do that. Mm. Integrity and the reliability of the results. That was the 1960 Ghana census, and that became a model for developing country census work. They sent people to us for training in this field methodology. I wrote a little Vade Mecum on that, and they sent people for training from all over West Africa. Mm. Yeah.
And that was 2 years in the doing, the mapping and the census.
Yes. First of all, it was 2 years out of your hide because I had a full teaching load that was there all the time. So going to the census office and employing a lot of people too, that the survey department gave me a wing with drawing the maps. We drew about 9,000 maps, big ones, of each survey area. And I wrote reports, and they're in our library here. That was quite a big job. Now, after the census, because it was a de facto at a point of time, then to rush the maps out and to collate the statistics, I didn't do that, but I did collate and correct and check the coding system. So we had a coding system that had a special underpinning according to the scale of the area. That was big. So I did that full time. So then after that was out, and I was enjoying it all, but it was terribly over, you know, didn't sleep at night, worked at night. And with probably 100 cartographers drawing maps with me, and they slept under their tables. And it was, you're driven, if you set a deadline for a census, you're driven to do it, and we did it. But after it was completed, I wanted a break, and I wanted to get up to the north, and because that's a savannah, Guinea savannah woodland, moving towards Sahelian-type environment. No forest, just riverine, gallery forest. Different world.
Yes.
And I didn't know that world. Mm-hmm. And so when I was liberated from the responsibilities of the census, when it was finished and the reports were out, I resumed full-time teaching, of course, always, and I had no funding research. We didn't have any. But if you have a car with four wheels, you go and do it. Mm-hmm. And so I went up north, and that's when I discovered, again, it was serendipity in the sense that in the river valleys in the north, I noticed rows of broken houses, broken villages, and all in alignment with the course of the river. So the riverine disease, river blindness, produced by the black fly, Simonium nanosum, and with a parasite, it was a geographically expressed pattern. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I got into that. I got by doing interviews up and down the river valleys, in broken houses, and finding signs of earlier desertion of villages, and blind people. Some houses, everyone was blind, they couldn't see. So that was quite traumatic. And I developed a hypothesis of cycles, historical cycles, of advance and retreat of settlement in response to the advent of river blindness and the advance and retreat of river blindness. So I proposed that hypothesis, and it's been confirmed by later research. So that was my first introduction to medical geography.
And that was along some of the upper reaches of the Volta?
Yeah, the Black. I worked on the Red Volta, but it applies to the Black Volta as well.
At this stage, I'd like to welcome and introduce Professor David Wiley, the Director of the African Studies Center at Michigan State University and Professor of Sociology. We'll continue the dialogue on West Africa, but also start to raise questions to do with the role of Michigan State University in the study of Africa.
This is fascinating, John. I think we could continue the topic we've been on.
Yeah.
But while you're talking about your medical geography research and looking at the development of onchocerciasis in the Volta region, how did your research emerge? You followed other medical topics, I know, moving to schistosomiasis later, and I just wondered if you could sort of recount for us how your research interest in African geography changed over the years.
I think that once I had moved into the savannah and identified problems of river blindness, I became strongly interested in the area. I'd known inhabitants from the area who are Guruni speaking, or they're loosely called in the south Frafra, which is a reduction from Farafara, meaning good morning, how are you? The Frafra peoples, I realized that the northern savannas were a labor reservoir for the richer forest zones in the south. And laborers came down from the north at first for seasonal employment, because in the north you have 6 months of rainfall and 6 months of drought, 40 inches of rain in the 6 months. In the dry season, there's nothing to do but sit home and go hungry if you don't have good stores of food. So, I'd met many of the northerners. In fact, many of them I met in the army. They'd say Corporal Gonja, Sergeant Dagati, and Wuni Frafra, and these are names in my mind right now, vividly, and likable, friendly people, and I'm not being patronizing. I realized when I was up there that these are ethnic areas. Looking at the area, I characterize it as a labor reservoir with marginality of 6 months of rain and 6 months of virtually total drought. So you have to have a well-developed, stable ecological system to provide year-round nutrition. So in the blind, I began to investigate, in other words, the blind zone. And the first thing I looked at was seasonal hunger. People went hungry. And they would talk about the hungry season. So I took a set of body weights and height. And I had the local tax collector take me around. I'd mapped the area myself by hand survey. And house by house, and we measured body weights if people agreed, and height, so you can calculate weight-height ratios. And I did that at the time of greatest body weight gain, which is in the dry season. because the harvest is in, you can eat. So there's a big seasonality of weddings, also funerals. You're going to have a good funeral, or you put the body in the ground within 5 or 6 hours because it smells. But the funeral, you hold it off until the Christmas period when there's plenty of food. Weddings, the same. So people were stuffing millets and sorghums and slaughtering sheep and goats and eating so well. And then as the season progressed, you can't eat again until the early rains come, and you can eat the early millet, and you pray for the early millet too, so you can eat it. So there's a lot of seasonality in the life. So I took a second set of measurements at the end of the hungry season and compared the two, and that was published. So that was a reflection on how one adapts to marginality in that sense. And then I did studies of population densities based on census returns. And then my biggest field work there after the blindness was I did a big study on what I call the social roots of dispersed settlement. Because although there were villages, the houses were not close together. Each house was surrounded by a circle of farmland, and they had a few cattle which they kept in the house. They're so precious. And then they used the cattle dung, cattle manure, to then fertilize the sorghum and millet gardens around the house. And so you go into a house in the rainy season when the grain is growing, and there's a radial distribution thereby of fertilizer and plant growth. So next to the mud walls of the house, which are 7 feet high, you have maize up there, and you're in the maize and you can't see your way out. But you walk 100 yards out and the maize is not maize, but maize is a special introduced crop. But the grains are then waist high and then ankle high, so it's a direct fertilizer gradient. But the interesting thing about that socially is that everything was arranged by clan and by lineage. So I mapped out the clans and the lineages and produced a major paper for the Institute of the Royal Institute of African Studies in London. I called it the Clans of Nangodi. And it was my attempt to wrestle. Maya Fortes did pioneer work in Tallensi. And that was my attempt to wrestle with it as a geographer. And I mapped out the clans and the lineages. That was, I think, a major achievement. Just for one illustrated area. So, and then I didn't get back into disease work in northern Ghana until I turned to, I did a field study of lymphatic filariasis, elephantiasis, you know, where your limbs expand out with, become edemas with lymph. It's impeded lymph circulation, essentially.
And they call it big leg in East Africa.
Yes,
Big leg.
Big leg, yes.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
Especially for women, the legs, well.
Yes, absolutely. And also female genitalia, male genitalia, female breasts. So it's a devastating disease. It's a horrible disease to have. And I did a lot of photography on that disease and interviews and reporting and published a long paper in Social Science and Medicine on elephantiasis. But I figured that it was a disease essentially of development, because in areas that didn't have introduced dams and disease, you had low and sporadic spotty distribution of low levels of elephantiasis. they pronounce it locally as elephantiasis. But scientists would call it lymphatic filariasis. But in underdeveloped areas, it was there at a low level. But where the actually USAID, speaking of development, had supported the Ghana government by building two dams, two big dams and two irrigation areas, then people lived by the irrigation channels had devastating levels of elephantiasis. And it was a social disease. You wouldn't want to marry a woman who had it unless you had it yourself, because the testicles sometimes are so big you have to put a cloth around your neck, a scarf, you know, cotton, wrap it around your testicles, tie it around the back of your neck to hold the testicles up. So it's mobilizing.
Right.
Also, it has certain social, psychological dimensions to it, the disease. I'm beginning to forget what I want to say.
No, that's fine. But, so you moved on later then to schistosomiasis as the next
right.
stage.
Right. Well, on the elephantiasis, I found that that the healthcare system wouldn't treat it. You'd have mothers come into clinics with huge legs out like this, and walking 3 or 4 miles to a market, going to a clinic, bringing a sick baby with malaria into the clinic, and they'll inject the baby, cure the malaria, ignore the mother, ignoring the elephantiasis entirely, because you can't treat it. You can, of course, with the proper medications, but they didn't have them. So I pointed out some of these contradictions about disease prevalence and so it was there, but everyone turned a blind eye to it because they couldn't. There was no miracle cure at that time. Then I did a trilogy of studies on guinea worm disease. That's a disease where a worm comes out 3 feet long, and if it doesn't come out, you're in trouble because it'll produce severe calcification, arthritic conditions of knee joints, and really mess you up. So I did 3 field studies of that. So with schistosomiasis, it's always been there as a disease of development. And I did a big literature review with Charles Hughes on that early on. But I didn't get, and I've worked with the World Health on all of these diseases. That's part of my research history.
With a very, very long resume of articles on
schistosomiasis, bilharzia, the last field work I did was 97. It was after my strokes. And I didn't survive too well in the field. I knew I wouldn't be doing too many trips back. Physically difficult. And let's see now.
You were legendary in that you had your stroke and then immediately left for field work.
I was around
that there is no one more committed on MSU to field work than John Hunter.
Well, the thing is, I don't want to mislead anyone because I enjoy the work. And for me, work is, if you call it work, it's a hobby. I enjoy it. So why shouldn't you do the things you enjoy doing?
Right.
And with the schistosomiasis, it used to be often difficult in the olden days to do research on schisto, bilharzia, because you either had to collect stools in the morning, and I did that with someone in Sierra Leone. And you smear these smelly stools onto a microscopic plate and stain it and look at it and count the eggs and so on. or you do a centrifuge of urine samples and count the eggs. Difficult and tedious and laborious, not all that accurate anyway. If you want to quantify the egg counts, now with biochemical assay sticks, chemical reagent, enzyme reactive dipsticks, you can, if this is urine, you can dip it in and in 60 seconds or a minute and a half, I can give you the level of blood in the urine. You can't see any, but it's there, could be there. And that then becomes an accurate measurement of, in this case, schistosomiasis hematobium. So my field research, which was approved by the World Health, although they didn't fund it, but it was funded by the National Geographic Society, was a measurement of blood in the urine as an indicator of schistosomiasis. Mm-hmm. So that was the work I did in 1996 in southern Ghana and 1997 in northern Ghana. It was so quick and efficient that I did, I think, 160 schools in northern Ghana on that survey. It's not, there's one big publication from it yet, but more to come. Because I haven't had the
when
time.
Did you first do work in Sierra Leone? Because I think by the time I came here, Sierra Leone was even more of a focus for you than Ghana.
Well, I spent a Fulbright there. My wife and I lived there for a year. And we went to N'Djala, which is a little agricultural, it was an agricultural research station, a government agriculture research station in the heart of Sierra Leone, in that area of Mende and Temne settlements in Derived Forest. It wasn't original fire forest. It's heavily farmed area, but it was really interesting. And that was our base camp for the Fulbright. And I bought a little VW Beetle made in Brazil, a wonderful little car, because if it gets stuck in the mud, you can call out the village people and eight people just pick it up and walk out with it. And that happened. It was stuck on a bridge once. They had, I'm digressing, but they had bamboo bridges or not bamboo, round palm fronds. No, I said not. Well, take coconut. Coconut trunks of perhaps 10 inches circumference. And you have two of them going across a deep stream. And you've got to put your wheels on each one. And I remember once we slipped and we were trapped, you know, the car slipped down, trapped there, and we were lifted out by a village people. For them, I paid them, of course, handsomely, but for them it was principally a joke. Why wouldn't you walk? Why, you know.
Yes.
But the Fulbright was our way into Sierra Leone. And I wanted something that was different from Ghana. And it worked out very well because, every week for two or three nights, sometimes four, we would leave our base camp in N'Djala and drive to villages. And with the chief's permission in the village, chiefs are very powerful influence in Sierra Leone, sleep in the village, because I felt that would bring me very close to the culture and the people and their foods and problems. And so we did that for a year. It was wonderful. It was quite wonderful. Yep.
And what was your research for that year?
It was primarily, well, so as always, I have a little hobbies. One of my hobbies is clay eating clay in pregnancy. And I did study that in Ghana, and I studied that in Sierra Leone. And I haven't published much of my Sierra Leone stuff yet, but I published one paper on insect clays eaten in pregnancy because of the delivery of micromineral nutrients to the fetus. But that would be like a sideline for me, a hobby. My principal research in Sierra Leone was the healthcare system. Who was sick with what? And where would you go with certain types of sickness? And so I went to hospitals and clinics and did a lot of work, which has to be analyzed and written up, and I haven't done it 20 years ago now. But I intend to. And reflecting on the disruption in Sierra Leone since, I did want to go back, but I decided not. Because some of the areas we went to, beyond the diamond fields, we visited hospitals with doctors and nurses from Europe, German Baptist Mission, Swedish Seventh Day, different denominations giving healthcare service. Many of them have been murdered now. So I decided I wouldn't take the risk and go back. But in our time, whatever you like of or think of Pashaka, the president, he kept the peace. The government may have been corrupt, of course, and it was, and it may not have been representative.
This is Shaka Stevens.
Shaka Stevens.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he kept it by having what I'd call a constructive ambivalence, like he was born in one Mende village, and there'd be a shrine there, and there'd be a process to unify the Mendes. And then he was allegedly born also in a Temne village with a similar matching setup. So it was a constructive ambivalence. And it's a joke, but it worked. Of course, when he left, it descended into chaos, especially, I think, destructive of the tribal system. Because the tribal system is a way of integrating people socially by tribe, of course. Although that's a forbidden word. You can't use the word tribe anymore, but by ethnic group and language and dialect and so on. He made it work. but with the amputation and that has been going on, those leaders who did that came in from Liberia, you read that they've been trained in Eastern Europe in techniques of intimidation. I haven't verified that, and it's not my business, I think. The political scientists should do that. But it's not African to go around. I think in the colonial Congo, the Belgian authorities used to cut off hands, didn't they?
Yes, in the red rubber days.
Right.
And in French Congo, too.
Right, so there are precedents for it. But that was just quite dreadful. I think Sierra Leone, to me, is a nightmare of what it used to be.
John, as you look back on your experience in Ghana, I think one thing we're all struck by is out of the period that you were there and teaching, Ghana exported an astonishing number of intellectuals and judges and lawyers and academics. There's hardly a university in Africa you don't find Ghanaians. Now we have a Secretary General of the United Nations. I'm wondering if you have a feeling about the... Was there something special about Ghana? Was there something special about that the colonial experience added to the Ghanaian people? How do you understand that?
I think that I think probably the Ghanaians should take the credit. Because it's very unwise to generalize, comparing one nation with another nation or one country with another country. But I'll take the risk and characterize Ghanaians as having a culture of accommodation and of avoiding extremism. And perhaps the colonial experience helped in that sense, that the Northerners had to work with the Southerners. The Kwa-speaking peoples had to work with the Gua-speaking, big language families. The forest peoples worked with the savanna peoples. And they were integrated under a lingua franca, English, with a good colonial educational system. Not just colonial, but in which there was lots of missionary and religious education of a high quality. The white fathers were well-educated people and taught. And so it was... I don't support colonialism and never will, but it did have its beneficial aspects that you'd be dishonest not to recognize them. And... Right. And then the advent of the cocoa industry brought a lot of wealth to the country itself, which was plowed back into the country in many different ways, go to Lagos and so on. So they came out a generation or two generations of well-educated senior leadership. Perfectly capable of speaking Latin or Greek and matching their wits with any European. And so if you go there as any preconceived notions of superiority going to Lagos, you'd be soon brought down to your knees. So that was good, and what you say is true about the dispersal and levels. It's changing now.
Mm-hmm.
It's changing. Yeah. The universities, which would sleep one student to a room, or perhaps two to a room, are now overcrowded, like 15 to a room. Mm-hmm. And of course you can't sleep, and the water systems are overtaxed. Mm-hmm. And so if you have universal education but without the provision, then the higher education without books is pretty hollow, mm-hmm. meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a crisis that the Ghanaian government has to face,
right?
In my opinion.
John, with all this Ghana, Sierra Leone, and British background, how do you come to MSU?
Well, that's an easy question. Because I had begun publishing, and I had published one major article on river blindness, the hypothesis that was in the Geographical Review, which was published by the American Geographical Society of New York. That was one. And then I had published in the Annals of the American Association of Geographers,
mm-hmm.
two articles on northern Ghana in back-to-back issues. So with those three and then other publications in the Institute of British Geographers and others too, African studies here at MSU began to take note. And so I met my now dear friend Harm de Blay in an African Studies conference in Edinburgh, Scotland. And he said, well, why don't you come and join us? We like your work, publications. And I said, oh, yeah, sure, yes. I didn't believe him. He said, send me your CV. And I didn't, because then I was teaching in Durham. And I was tenured at the University of Durham. A very nice little cathedral city and so on, and a good university. And I didn't send the CV, and then the phone rang in the middle of the night. Where the hell is your CV? Because I didn't know whether it was a serious invite. So I sent it, and then I was invited to come for interview. And I came for interview in 1966, Thanksgiving. And gave two or three talks and met with faculty and seminars and so on. And I was very impressed with the African Studies Center, because we didn't have one in Durham at all. And even the idea was sort of new to me, that they have people who specialize in African studies. It makes good sense when you think about it, especially if you can also think of the interdisciplinarity of scholarship that constitutes a center. Not just African studies and geography, but a center by its nature embraces history and other disciplines, geography, others, languages, economic sciences, and so on. So I liked it. And so arrived to teach in the early summer of 1967. So I came then because I was invited to, but before that, because I had published some major papers. Mm-hmm. And I was flattered that my scholarship had been recognized.
Okay. Who were the other people besides Harm DeBlay in geography and so on that were key in the, that attracted you to the university at that time?
Well, I met with the Africanists repeatedly over like a 2 or 3 day period, and DeBlay, of course, is an outstanding speaker and writer. He's written 7 or 8 books, or even more by now. And he went on to a famous career in Good Morning America, American TV, where he could, in a few minutes, could give the geography of any world situation. So I wish I had his skills to speak like that, but he's captivating. That was very impressive. But then I met others like Mark Schwartz, the anthropologist, an Africanist. Mm-hmm. Charles Hughes, the director of the center, an anthropologist. I was very impressed speaking with them. And Jim Hooker, the late Jim Hooker. I was always impressed with his mind, his intellectuality, his comradeship, and many others too. And so I knew they had a serious enterprise going here. So I wouldn't jeopardize my career. On the contrary, by coming, I could launch it further.
So you're saying it was the interdisciplinary character of
yes.
the interest in Africa that at MSU that
yeah,
that attracted you here.
Right. Right, and the good minds at work. Speaking with these people, you realize they were serious about their work.
Uh-huh.
And that creates a good atmosphere.
Right. Were they bound together in a center program at that time?
Yes.
Yeah.
And of course, it wasn't as large as it is now, and so that it's easier to form little cohesions and networks and so on. But we used to run a weekly seminar, it would. About once a term only, you could give a paper as a faculty member, which would be attended by other faculty, and that mm-hmm. was very good. Mm-hmm. You talk about your current ongoing research and so on, and you know it's hard. You give a seminar; it's hard to get others to turn out, but it would be one evening every 2 weeks, say something like that, And then another format, which was quite unifying, was we taught in Wells Hall, you know, 500 seats, and we began an interdisciplinary African studies program oriented for credit, and the credit could be given in pretty well every department who signed off for it. So we wouldn't be giving credit in African studies. You can't do that at MSU, but you can give credit through an academic department. So if you have sociology, sign off, importantly, and then history and geography and some other disciplines, education, you can quickly, and if you have good speakers and you don't talk down to the audience, we could fill Wells Hall, and we did. And so it's a bit of a strain, you know, for a person to give a talk to 500 people in Wells Hall. But the acoustics are good. I think you lose energy through osmosis. If you just stand there and say nothing, you lose energy to the audience. Mm-hmm. But that was very successful. Mm-hmm. And it was a unifying thing for the faculty.
Mm-hmm. Around those seminars.
As well as the small seminars of a dozen faculty.
John, you came here at the time of racial protest in this country.
Yes, yes.
Over discrimination.
Right.
Did that have an impact on kind of the climate of dealing with Africa?
Yes, yes, it did. Because we had sit-ins. Sam Riddle was one of the leaders. There was a lot of anger, a lot of racial anger. Demonstrated by our African-American fellow citizens and colleagues and friends. So why should a bunch of white guys, you know, preempt the teaching forums to teach about Africa when they're white? A lot of anger. And we had several sit-ins. Well, one, I have to be accurate here. But there were sit-ins, and as a consequence, an immediate consequence, Charles Hughes resigned, our director. He was as an anthropologist, I believe now deceased, he had worked on a psychiatric medical survey in Nigeria and written a long, long paper or not a monograph, but a smallish one on that. So he was legitimate. And he'd worked with Nigerian psychiatrists too. But he didn't, he also had a short fuse, and he didn't enjoy arguing to justify his involvement in an intellectual academic study. Mm-hmm. And so he resigned. And he went on to a good position in the medical school.
Uh-huh. Right. So,
but that left us leaderless. Yeah. So that was the effect of it. And I remember being in one meeting with Riddle and other supporting African Americans, and the meeting was attended. I was there, and Dean Winder was there. I'm not sure. And I think Smuggler was there too.
Mm-hmm.
And we were abused, you know. Mm-hmm. We were called MF, you know, mother something or other. And it was pretty violent stuff, and verbally, and rather extremist. And one of the speakers had a reputation for carrying a gun. And he was stopped by the police for the gun, so it was confirmed.
Mm. So these were primarily members of the African-American community who wanted
entirely
more say in what African studies was doing or wanted control of it, or were they asking for an African-American studies program?
I think they're asking for a voice. Mm-hmm. And if by shutting down the center, they could take control. They would have. I felt they were quite legitimate to seek a voice for African American studies. But I think that there's so much work to be done for mm-hmm. better understanding and research. There's enough scope and need for an African Studies Center per se to study African problems. Mm-hmm. And it shouldn't matter much what your pigmentation is.
Right.
And then, of course, there's an important need to address the concerns and the injustice and the history of injustice of African Americans. And so if an African American study center can do that, it should, and it should be created. Mm-hmm. So I didn't see the conflict in the disparate polarizing terms that the locals did. And when I was acting in the center, I had a couple of sit-ins myself, but I didn't feel, I wasn't protagonistic, but I didn't feel like running away either. I know a couple of African-American women came in and sat in my office, and I was happy to meet them and talk about it. And they came in with the attitude, what's this white guy doing here? What's his relevance to our needs and concerns? And they're good questions.
Do you think this was all accentuated by Michigan State not having an African-American or Afro-American studies program?
Well, we did, of course. You know, we had Bob
the Center on Urban Affairs.
Who was the Dean of Urban Affairs, which is the... If there are foci, special foci of African Americans' concerns and problems, it's the cities and the inner cities. So his program should have and could have been renamed mm-hmm. to cover that more explicitly, but de facto it was there. Mm-hmm. But when these women came into my office and said, what's this white guy doing here? You know, and I said, well, he must be a South African. I said, no, I'm not a South African. And I said, I used to teach in Ghana. I lived in Ghana 9 years. And most of my colleagues were African. My head of department was a black African. The dean of the college was a black African. The university president was a black African. So, and it was an independent black African country. And so you go on like that for 5 or 10 minutes, and they say, well, he's not really a white racist. So I could prove that to my own satisfaction.
Right.
And I gave them all the support that they needed, always.
What effect did that have then on the evolution of the center after that period?
Well, you know, I took over, as you know, for 2 years, and I felt that we needed, if we could only find them, black faculty for visibility, black graduate students, to show that African studies was an entirely suitable field for the involvement of African American students, and that perhaps we should do more to recruit them, and perhaps identify federal scholarships for black students.
Was the appointment of Alfred Opubor as the director of the center for a few years, was that did that come out of that period?
Yes, it did. He was appointed by Dean Smuckler to replace Charles Hughes. And it was a beautiful fit because he's an American-educated African and totally in sympathy with African-American points of view, and well-respected intellectual, articulate, charming. And so it was a very, very good appointment.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble was that he resigned after a couple of years.
Right. John, the other influence on the study of Africa at MSU in that period was the University of Nigeria project at Nsukka, where there were quite a few Michigan State faculty over. I think someone once said we had perhaps 200 man and woman years of time spent there, and here you had brought the Sierra Leone and Ghanaian focus, but suddenly you have this huge infusion of faculty with Nigerian experience.
Right, right.
Not so much research faculty always, but people with teaching experience there.
Yeah.
What kind of impact did that have on the shape of study of Africa?
I didn't know all of them well enough, but when I did a faculty survey, Smuckler, after Charles had resigned, Dean Smuckler asked me to think of research directions for the center, and I began by making a survey of faculty strength across campus, and I wrote to all departments and everyone in the university who had as far as I could ascertain, any interest in Africa, had been there, Peace Corps, whatever. And this included all the Nsukka people, and there are many of them. And some of those Nsukka people were not dedicated Africanists, openly. But with others, like John Henderson in economics,
John Hanson in education.
Absolutely.
And the Axons.
Henderson became devoted Africanists in the sense of loyalty and institutional support that they could offer. They were perfect for us. Yeah. But they weren't automatically the best researchers. Some mm-hmm. were, some were not.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we have to look for a brand of faculty loyalty, faculty support, faculty excellence in teaching. That comes first.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't teach a good course, you're not much use in the university. Here in the Midwest, anyway.
Right. Today, Michigan State is producing more dissertations, PhD dissertations on Africa,
mm-hmm.
than any other U.S. university. And I guess, was this focus on scholarship in this period, is that the foundations that we're building on that have created that? It seems that in the period you're describing, that the focus on research in Africa was the sine qua non. That was really the focus of the life.
For a faculty member, he or she would be expected to have done research in Africa, like Ruth Hamilton in sociology. I met her in Africa doing research before she or I ever came to MSU. Yes, it would be a sine qua non. And the research, we had scholarships for graduate students in Charles Hughes' day, some few scholarships, I don't know the number. But there was a hiatus when we totally lost the funding. It was under a PUBO. Our funding was totally severed.
For a 3-year period, I guess it was. Yeah. I believe.
As I say, it's like being an underwater deep sea diver, you know, with a rubber tube breathing air, and it's suddenly cut. That was utterly traumatic. And so, as you know, I spent some time writing two consecutive proposals, and both were successful. And I think the first one I wrote raised, I think it was 15 or 16 graduate research fellowships. And they're permanent, just renewable. And then a lot of money for faculty appointments, too. Mm-hmm. So that would be my greatest achievement, I think, in African mm-hmm. studies, was to restore the funding and mm-hmm. amplify it and to seek good faculty, such as yourself, who would yeah. carry the banner and build for the future, as you have done. And this applies to our graduate students, because there's now a long tradition of Africa-related PhD graduates from Michigan State University. Although I will say it's much more difficult to complete a field-based PhD in Africa now than it was in my day.
Right.
Much more difficult.
Did you have a lot of support in this, in the work of building African studies from people like Hannah and Smuckler, Winder, Taggart?
Yes, I would say all of them, they were all enthusiastic to see it get going again. And, support was not hands-on support, it was mm-hmm. hands-off, but Smuckler was always encouraging for this.
There are many stories of strong relationships between President Hanna and Nnamdi Azikiwe, the first civilian president of Nigeria, as in the startup of the Nsukka project.
Yes.
And it seems like there was an Africa interest there that is distinct from some of the Eastern universities, which focus primarily on Asia.
That's beyond my ken. I just don't know that. You'd have to probe a little deeper into the history of it to find that out. I'm sure it's true. But it wasn't... that was all embraced under the umbrella of Nsukka.
Right, right. But it's fascinating that some of the larger African centers are right here in a cluster in the Big Ten universities.
Yes.
Right, with Michigan State and Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana.
I think it's wonderful.
So, do you think that reflects the kind of the match between the land grant principles of outreach and with the African need for development in the early independence years? Is that?
Yes, it did, and I think there are others who'll speak to this better than I can. Our faculty in agricultural economics and agrobotany and so on, like Eicher. And lead home with strong ties with the USAID and good recurrent funding from USAID represented that aspect of the work that we did.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Those of us who were not funded by USAID were a little bit jealous of their funding support, but nevertheless admired and respected what they did do.
It is striking when one looks at the funding picture today. I was to see that first of all that MSU's funding for studying the rest of the world, Europe, Middle East, Latin America, mm-hmm. Africa, and so on, that the African as faculty bring about close to three fourths of that funding into the university, and half of that roughly is agriculture. And do you think that developed out of the kind of the consonance of MSU having a strong agriculture and the USAID priorities? And I'm contrasting that, John, a little bit with the seeming lack of focus on African health issues, which has been dealt with a bit sporadically at MSU with some sterling research and service, but not with the kind of programmatic extensiveness that agriculture had.
Well, regarding African health, I wrote the first proposal. It didn't become the one that was used fully as is, but to create an institute of international health,
mm-hmm.
and supported by our medical school. So I was concerned about that enough to write the proposal, and did go with Dean Megan on several trips to Africa to establish those linkages. And some of the outcomes today, the best example would be Terry Taylor, mm-hmm. who's now internationally famous for her work in child malaria, cerebral malaria, and so on. So that was a concern. But the faculty appointments, in the two proposals that I wrote and funded, and it wasn't just a question of writing, because it did involve going to Washington, D.C. to meet with congressional representatives and also AGW personnel to interview them to make sure that we submitted the finest possible, most persuasive proposal. But that secured faculty funding. Then the next job was to come back to our departments, and not just agriculture, because they, with the USAID funding, they were comfortable. But underfunded departments like in the humanities and sociology, anthropology, geography, and so on, and library sciences. I then came back, as you'll recall, to with FTEs. Mm-hmm. And then it's very then you have to be as persuasive as you can to sit down with the chair and his or her advisory committee and say, I have half of an FTE for you in journalism. If you make it African journalism, or give it an African orientation, or linguistics, mm-hmm. or anthropology. If you can match our 50% with your 50% in an online position, we can, and you can pick your own best candidate. Mm-hmm. It's very persuasive, and mm-hmm. it worked. Mm-hmm. So I could take an FTE and divide it into two positions. With online funding. I did the same when I was acting chair in community health, where I felt that we needed more human nutrition in our medical training, and so I was given an FTE, mm-hmm. and I split that four ways. So I had four professors of human nutrition, each with a 25% FTE in community health. It worked beautifully.
Mm. And that's made a difference in the
It does make a difference. Yeah, and it did with our African studies.
Anyway, we would like to see the African health area grow and have equal support. Are there other major factors that you think fed into the fact that African studies is relatively so strong in the faculty at MSU? Is it a matter of synergy in which people interested in Africa know this is a good place to go for library and for other faculty?
I think the NERV Center has been and always will be the African Studies Center. Mm-hmm. And then If they have funding sources that are annually renewable, a lot can be done creatively with that funding to continue the growth. Because with aging and retirement and death, and premature death, and losses of faculty, there's a constant, continuing need to enrich our faculty positions. Like Peter Lim, for instance, is a great asset mm-hmm. in African studies. But we need a Peter Lim every year to be added.
Right.
Or the equivalents.
John, a big question. Some senior administrators at MSU have suggested that the center should pay more attention to Africa's problems in shaping what it does and the faculty and so on, and that perhaps there should not be so much attention to history and culture and perhaps even social science, but it should be much more overt focus on problems of health and agriculture to feed a hungry Africa and so on. Especially at the Land Grant University, do you think that is a wise course for?
No, no, I don't think so. If you become too utilitarian, you lose a breadth of vision, you lose some sensitivity. I think there's always been a place for the social sciences and humanities, as well as environmental sciences. They all add to the understanding of Africa and African problems. To imagine an African problem without a human dimension is ludicrous.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we should encourage the recruitment of faculty in a diverse array of disciplines that address Africa.
Can I just come in here and ask about African students at MSU and mm-hmm. how have you seen patterns develop there with Africans coming to study here and maybe also take up faculty positions?
They do well. They mostly don't want to go back. And the more talented they are, the more able they are to secure good positions here in the States. It's not a problem. You can say, well, it's a brain drain problem for African universities. But that's true. I've never heard of any criticisms of African students who do well in our academic system and go forward.
How did that develop over time? In your period as director of the centre, were there a number of African students here? Did it grow? When were the nodes of growth there?
I couldn't say really, but I haven't known a time when we didn't have African students on campus, and they're very welcome. And those among them who were less achieving academically did tend to go back to Africa, but those who were upwardly aspiring, distinctive abilities. Not in African studies per se, you know, like could be computer science. I don't see it as a problem.
What about with African languages? Were they being taught here when you
yes.
came?
Yes, and we've always funded them. It's one of David's headaches is to find the funding. And then also we have a problem, like one African language doesn't make a center, you know, like one swallow a spring does not make. It can't be all Hausa, or it can't be all Swahili. You need 20 or 30 different languages, and David's response has been to recruit students who are already on campus majoring in mathematics or computer science, and if they have a language for which we have a need, even for one student, we can hire that African student as a tutor to one of our graduate students. So that's the response to the model, and for that you need a manager who's trained in the linguistics of African languages. And we've been fortunate. We've always had one or two people able to do that, and with permanent funding. You need that. From that, you can spin off quite an effective African language program.
John, we're faced at a difficult time in Africa's history with a lot of disease, malaria rampant still, as well as HIV and AIDS. The area that you have studied in Africa so much is at almost at a crisis level at this stage, and then with the African economies not doing well in this mm-hmm. increasingly globalized market, and then with African, more difficult to do research in Africa with the resource problems, stability problems. Mm-hmm. I just wonder, given all of this, one of our elders who's watched all this, the growth of African studies almost since its beginning at MSU in 1960.
Yeah.
I was wondering what your own perspectives are, how we as American scholars relate to and deal with and Africa in this new millennium.
It's easy to indulge in pessimism. I say indulge because that's a loaded word, isn't it? But but I think we have to make conscious efforts not to be too pessimistic, that we can continue to work in Africa. It takes more preparation now than it used to in terms of contacts with African friends and research areas and countries and thematically. If it's technical research, it needs more funding now than it used to. But we mustn't give up the struggle, mustn't give up the hope. We must continue to do research. And I would be in Africa now if my health would hold up.
Mm-hmm.
So all you say is true, it's correct. And there are huge problems. And you mentioned AIDS. HIV, and that's an ongoing struggle. Happily, it hasn't been so severe in West Africa as mm-hmm. it has in Central.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I haven't gotten into that area of research myself. It takes a lot of organization. I nearly got into some AIDS research in Zimbabwe mm-hmm. with Evangelos Petropoulos. But that it fell through, largely because the ethical questions of who receives the medication and who mm-hmm. doesn't,
mm-hmm.
Who receives the placebo and who doesn't,
mm-hmm.
we haven't resolved those questions,
mm-hmm.
so we didn't get into that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have loved to get into the geography and spread of AIDS. In the early days, at least.
John, are there some topics about Africa, African studies, and your long love affair with Africa that you want to comment on before we close this interview?
Well, I have a lifetime of unfinished projects. That's my history. I publish about 10% of my research mm-hmm. and want to get the rest out. Mm-hmm. Always fighting for time to do it. So at the personal level, it's a never-ending. And right now, of course, I'm leaving East Lansing, which will make it more difficult for me. But I'm keeping retaining all my links with MSU.
Good.
Including my email address.
Well, we thank you for your many, many years of marvelous service to Africa and for, I believe, one of the founders of the system that has produced the scholarship and the reputation of both faculty and then with it the students in recent years, and creating those positions in African studies that brought a number of us here to Michigan State. You helped create very clearly what very early became Michigan State's premier area studies, and I think the faculty and students here that benefited from that owe you a very great deal. So thank you for that.
Well, in response, David, I don't want it to sound gratuitous, but when you came and you took over the directorship of the center, and you've been doing that job now for nearly 30 years, is it?
Almost 25, I think.
25, yeah. You've done a marvelous job. Mm. Much better than I could ever have done myself.
Wow.
And you've held the ship together and given good leadership.
But it was easy with the foundation that you had built.
That's
with
the core trouble. You end, we all end up in gratuitous.
Well, maybe we can thank everyone and hopefully continue this conversation at a later date. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.